We'll hear argument now in the case of Brady against Pfister. Mr. Rufo.
Good morning. May it please the Court. This case arises out of a habeas corpus petition filed by the petitioner challenging a 2002 conviction for first-degree murder following a bench trial in the Circuit Court of Cook County. The sole claim for habeas relief advanced by the petitioner that remains in this appeal is a claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel for failing to call four witnesses at trial who have subsequently provided affidavits regarding what testimony they could have provided. Petitioner advanced this argument in a state court post-conviction petition, which was dismissed in the trial court and dismissed summarily in the Illinois appellate court. The petitioner then raised the issue on habeas. The district court held the defendant's trial counsel was deficient under Strickland for failing to call the four witnesses, and that the Illinois appellate court's ruling otherwise was unreasonable, but it also found that petitioner failed to establish that the appellate court either unreasonably applied the prejudice prong of Strickland or unreasonably determined the facts in light of the evidence presented. However, in doing so, the district court improperly analyzed the trial court's reasonings for finding the petitioner guilty rather than the finding of the appellate court, Illinois appellate court, denying the post-conviction petition, which would have been...
So I wanted to ask you about that because it strikes me as odd that if a state appellate court gives, I'll exaggerate a little bit, you know, a flawed explication, let's say, for why there's no prejudice, but hypothetically, the state trial court has a perfect discussion of it, has hit all the right things, has talked about it with learning and attention to the record and so on, that on, given the overall theme in 2254 of deferring to the decisions of the state courts, we're supposed to blind ourselves to my hypothetical perfect discussion in the state trial court and say to the state, well, yeah, but your appellate court affirmed the trial court for reasons that failed to carry forward this perfect discussion. Doesn't that sound a little peculiar to you?
That may be what the district court ultimately decided to do, because the Illinois appellate court did give a somewhat cursory review of the merits
right.
of the petition.
They give a cursory review, and what the district court here does, he looks through that, and he also tries to, in a sense, supplement his understanding of what it was the state appellate court was affirming by seeing what was before the state appellate court, namely the state trial court decision. And I try to ask myself, you know, if this situation came before the Supreme Court, are they likely to say that you are forbidden to look through to see what the state trial court said as a way of gaining a full understanding of the state judicial system's conclusion?
I can't necessarily predict what the Supreme Court would or wouldn't do, but as the law stands now...
Given their track record in habeas cases, you wouldn't want to venture a guess.
I suppose I may at some point, but as the law stands right now in McFowler v. Jamet, this court said the relevant decision for purposes of the assessment under 2254D is the decision of the last state court to rule on the merits of the petitioner's claim.
That's true, and I guess what I'm trying to probe is how we should understand that. Now, if the last state court to discuss the claim has, you know, said, oh, we don't think Strickland should apply, you know, we think Lockhart should apply, or something like that, then it seems to me that's an error of law. The Supreme Court has had that case, and one is entitled to take the state court at its word. But if the lower court in the state system has done it right, and the real flaw at the appellate court level is just being cursory, I'm just not sure whether the Supreme Court has ever addressed the question how one relates the two state court decisions.
I'm not sure they have either, but it seems to me that the law as it stands now requires an analysis of the Illinois Appellate Court's decision. And the Illinois Appellate Court's decision here unreasonably applied the prejudice prong of Strickland by improperly holding Brady to an improperly high standard of prejudice. It appears that the ruling of the Illinois Appellate Court on the prejudice prong of Strickland is limited.
Put Judge Wood's question in a different way.
Okay.
Is there anything in the decision of the state's appellate court that disagrees with the reasons given by the state trial judge?
I'm not sure that it necessarily disagrees, but it doesn't appear to rule on the same basis.
Right.
It has its own independent finding when it said...
Let's suppose you have a situation in which the trial judge says, I reject a claim for reasons A and B, and the appeals court says that decision is affirmed and gives reasons C, doesn't mention A and B.
Well,
B haven't been rejected or disposed of. There's no statement by the state judiciary that A and B are not our view. And I agree with the burden of Judge Wood's question, which is, given the AEDPA, wouldn't it be very strange to say the federal court now should just ignore A and B?
Well, taking your hypothetical, it seems to me that if the trial court makes a finding on A and B, and the actual outcome is determined, or the outcome is affirmed, but because of reason C, not necessarily in addition to, then the case law would suggest that it is only reason C that should be applied.
Case law. We're asking whether something makes sense. We'll make the case law.
Absolutely.
But I will also throw in Harrington against Richter as case law that might tend to make you think that we're not grading the completeness of the state court's discussion.
Now, that may be. Now, if that analysis that the district court did perform is proper, then I think there still is an issue because the trial court, and then perhaps the Illinois appellate court, assuming that it has adopted the trial court's reasoning, unreasonably applied the prejudice prong of Strickland by failing to fully appreciate the import of petitioner's proposed testimony.
Well, I mean, getting to these four affidavits for a minute, these struck me as quite a distance less compelling, say, than the affidavits in the Raygoza case, where there were, I mean, the Raygoza case, if you had believed those other witnesses, there's a ironclad alibi for the person, whereas the affidavits that Mr. Brady is relying on are far more indirect, right?
It may be a matter of degree, but the state's theory of prosecution in this case was that the petitioner shot his girlfriend after an altercation that left the bedroom they shared in a state of disarray.
Well, everybody agrees he shot her. He agrees he shot her.
Yes.
It's all about intent, right? And
yes.
This kind of bizarre evidence that that the other guy came in, I'm forgetting his name right now, and turned the bedroom upside down. I don't know. I mean, once he's admitted that he shot her, how pertinent is that evidence?
Well, it was the state's theory that it was a physical altercation between the two that left the bedroom in that state. The evidence that it was not a physical altercation but someone else entirely undercuts that theory. And that's what I think the purpose of Marshawn Brady's testimony would have shown at trial that, and I agree with you that it seems a little bizarre at first glance, but I think an evidentiary hearing on the issue would have borne it out more fully. And I'm into my rebuttal time, so if there are no further questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counselor, may it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Garson Fisher for the respondent. I'd like to begin by addressing Judge Wood's question about the theme of 2254 and most recently Harrington v. Richter. I think we can we can say safely that the U.S. Supreme Court and the law itself are pretty clear that it's the judgment and not the reasoning that's subject to review in application of 2254D's relitigation bar.
But here's my problem with taking that too far. The statute certainly calls for evaluation of whether something is either contrary to or an unreasonable application of governing Supreme Court standards. And if the state court has actually written an opinion, then that's what we evaluate for contrary to. Again, to take my example, if the state's court says this is a Lockhart case and it's really a Strickland case, that's properly, we know from the Supreme Court, held to be contrary to established law. If you go all the way to say, well, it's really just the bottom line, and if we anything we can imagine, no matter what they said, is enough to uphold it, I think that runs into conflict with other language in the statute. So we have to give some weight, I think, to whatever it is the state court said, even if we might, in our infinite wisdom, with lots of hindsight, have written a better or different opinion.
Well, and I think in this case, we don't have to resolve the tension that perhaps exists between Harrington v. Richter on the one hand and you know, cases, for example, that treat the two Strickland prongs where one prong has been addressed and not the other one. We don't have to resolve that tension in this case because the court in this case applied the correct standard. It cited to Strickland. It stated the standard correctly. It discussed the facts of the case. It discussed the bias of the witnesses, which, while not sufficient in and of itself to make evident that there's no prejudice in a case like this, where, as you address, even if the witnesses had been presented and the trier of fact had believed these witnesses, they wouldn't have negated the state's evidence of intent in this case. Couple that with the bias of the witness and of the witnesses and the implausibility of some of the story on its face, I think.
But the bias point, I mean, that's actually an odd point for them to have stressed, since witnesses are frequently, I mean, that would take you all the way to the old common law rule that you couldn't testify in your own case, much less, you know, have your relatives or other friends testifying. Who's likely to be around? People you know. So there's always going to be some bias. I thought that was really not a particularly good point.
And the emphasis in the analysis that the appellate court chose, I thought, was less informative than the emphasis in the analysis that the district court chose.
Trial court did a better job, is what it gets down to, which is why I'm interested in how, from our point of view, as a federal court applying 2254, we're supposed to reconcile this consistent message, you look at the last state court that did anything, with the fact that perhaps it's an entire judicial system that's produced the result we're looking at.
I don't think that there is anything to the language of 2254, its purpose, or the case law that would suggest that the 2254D relitigation bar should be lowered if the reasoning of the appellate court is perhaps not as finely tuned as the reasoning of the court whose judgment it's affirming.
Unless perhaps, as Judge Easterbrook was suggesting, it actually disapproves what the lower court did?
I think if an appellate court affirmatively stated an opinion that both disavowed an earlier reasonable opinion and then in its own reasoning put forward an objectively unreasonable opinion, that would constitute the circumstances under which the relitigation bar would be would be cleared and be subject to relitigation in federal court. But that's not the circumstances here. Again, it's the analysis is whether there's a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different. And in looking at that, you look at both the quality of the evidence that was at trial and the quality of the proposed evidence that wasn't presented. And the emphasis that the appellate court chose was was not, again, not as informative as the focus the district court chose, pointing out, for example, that these witnesses don't provide any explanation for defendant's flight, for him going on the lam. Petitioner has put forward at trial a theory that he actually was fleeing from the victim's relatives, but that doesn't explain why, when it was police and not vengeful relatives who caught up with him, he continued to maintain his alias. And the history of battery, his nervous behavior as described by witnesses around the time of the shooting, and the witnesses had no actual knowledge of the shooting. So while they do certainly tend to undermine some of the circumstantial evidence of intent, they don't negate the intent in this case, even if you had presented the witnesses and the trier of fact had chosen to believe them. That is.
So to what extent are you saying that the federal court, it sounds to me almost like you're making an argument for our de novo review of all of these four affidavits and what they would have contributed?
No, Your Honor. I think it is clear enough that there was no reasonable probability the outcome would have been different. It makes it very easy to say that it was not objectively unreasonable for the state court to reject the Strickland claim on the prejudice ground. I think for the sake of clarity, since I think this is a case where it's fairly easy to say that there was not prejudice, I'm addressing it in those terms. But obviously, mm-hmm. the relitigation bar requires far more than that. On habeas review. A couple of other quick points. The district court found that the state court's decision regarding the performance prong was objectively unreasonable, but that is not the case. First off, the state court concluded, based on the record in front of it, the evidence that was available to it at the time, that there was no evidence that these witnesses shared the information in their affidavits with counsel. The post-conviction petition did allege that counsel interviewed the proposed witnesses, but none of the witnesses averred that they shared that information with counsel, and there was no affidavit produced from counsel.
So you're just drawing a distinction between interviewing and saying, and we told him about this specific information.
And witnesses do sometimes share different information with different people at different times. One could infer from the evidence that was in front of the state court that these witnesses had shared that information with counsel, but it was not an unreasonable determination of the fact for the state court to come to the contrary conclusion based on the absence of evidence that they shared this information. And since the burden is on petitioner to overcome that determination by clear and convincing evidence, they haven't met their burden here. And if they didn't share that information with counsel, then counsel was not deficient in his performance. It certainly wasn't objectively unreasonable to hold that counsel was not deficient in failing to call these witnesses. I think then, unless the court has questions about the two prongs of Strickland in this case, I just want to very quickly address the appropriate remedy in case the court comes to a contrary determination than respondent's position that the state court was objectively unreasonable. Petitioner has said that respondent is missing the forest for the trees and arguing that an evidentiary hearing would be necessary to determine whether an actual constitutional violation occurred here. But I think it's evident that should the court disagree with respondent, it would be necessary to test the persuasiveness of these proposed witnesses, whether their story holds together upon cross-examination before granting habeas relief. So I think this court has made clear recently in Mosley that it agrees with respondent on this point, but want to make that clear. And unless the court has any further questions for the reasons stated here as well as in our briefs, respondent asks that this court affirm the district court's judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Anything further, Mr. Ruffo?
I just want to clarify quickly the record that was before the Illinois Appellate Court at the time it made decision. The petitioner did avow in his petition that the information was shared because counsel had interviewed the potential witnesses. And the Illinois Appellate Court, as it stated, was required to take the affidavits as true and liberally construe the petition itself, I think it is unreasonable to determine otherwise that the witnesses were interviewed but didn't share the information that they subsequently provided in the affidavits. And the respondent argued briefly on the deficiency prong of Strickland, which the district court found the Illinois appellate court was unreasonable in denying. But I also want to point out that both prongs of Strickland have been met.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.